Happy Monday. Welcome back to another episode of Morning Coffee with your host, Rick Alexander. You guys can follow me at @RickAlexander_ on Instagram if you want to interact with the show. Of course, the greatest compliment that you could give me is to share this show with somebody that you think the message may resonate with, or to head to iTunes and give us a 5-star review if you have a little extra time, just so that we can continue to climb the charts and get the message out there to more and more people. So I ordered this book a while ago called Strength to Love by Martin Luther King Jr. It's actually a pretty difficult book to find, and I had to buy a used copy of it. And what it is actually a bunch of his sermons, a bunch of the sermons that I guess a lot of people in his life had been asking him to put together so that they could have on paper and to read. And so basically he went through it and tried to make it more of a book. So he kind of like tried to make it more pleasant for reading instead of listening to. Now, something that's interesting, a lot of times I think when we talk about Martin Luther King Jr., we tend to forget that he was a preacher. And actually there are a bunch of times throughout history where some of the greatest talks or speeches that we know were actually sermons. And so Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech was actually a sermon. And I think that there's so much that we can learn from his life and his message. And in fact, when I got this book, I started to read it and I was gripped almost instantly. Like I felt as though nothing as much as this book has called me to be the absolute highest expression of who I am. Like the best of what humans can be, I believe that is what Martin Luther King Jr. was asking us to be. And so I've done a lot of research around this as well. So as I go through these, I forgot to tell you, as I read the book, I actually had the feeling of like, man, maybe I shouldn't even write any other books. Maybe I should just literally work on getting this book to more and more people, because I think it's such a relevant message. Now, of course, we've had a resurgence of the civil rights movement in America. And so we have this race division that's applicable. So it's a little more applicable right now based on what we're going through. But I would also say that regardless of the race thing, we always have these divisions that are going on, and our ego is always cutting reality up into them versus us. And there's always a they that we can blame our problems on. And if it's not racial injustice, maybe it's something, maybe it's oppressive government. Maybe it's you not being able to be who you actually are because other people aren't allowing you to be that in your life, to be the authentic version of you. And so that creates division. Like there are all these different reasons why this work is actually really applicable to our lives. And so I'm going to break it down. I'm also going to break down context. What I wanted to do this week, because I had some time off from school, is I wanted to really go through and do this book justice. And so I'm going to pick 5 of these. Hopefully I can do one each day this week. I'm going to pick 5 of these and I'm going to go through them. And what I'm going to do is I'm actually just going to read excerpts from it that stood out to me. And then I'm going to give a little bit of commentary into why. Now, the first one that we're going to go over today is called A Tough Mind and a Tender Heart. Remember, I really do believe these are like the highest expression of who we can be, because they call us to override our innate desire for simplicity. The ego wants simple, always. That's why we do divide the world up, so that we can understand it better, so that we can navigate it better. But oftentimes what happens in our simplicity of dividing the world up, that's bad, that's good, that's right, that's wrong, is we build this black and white world, and our humanity can't exist in a black and white world, because our humanity, it's not black and white, it's nuanced, it's complex. You know that you're nuanced, right? But you have a hard time seeing that in other people, or at least that's generally the case until we've done a lot of work to see our own shadows and things like that. So one of the things that I want to talk about before I get into the sermon is I want to talk about love as an organizing principle. So this is something I've talked about quite a bit, and I'm going to refer to an episode I did a couple of weeks ago throughout this week, because remember, I talked a little bit about what Jesus's life meant when he came into the Roman Empire and how we really didn't have a basis for sound moral structure prior to that. And so instead, what we considered to be justice was actually just based on a dominance hierarchy. And so it was justice as long as you were something like a male Roman citizen. Other than that, you found yourself below them, and so justice didn't really apply to you. So Jesus was the first person to come and say, hey, listen, you know, justice, it applies to everybody. And so constantly when people are kind of trying to like trip him up and catch him, they're like, hey, so what's the most important commandment? And he just, you know, sort of continually says to love God and to love people. And so the reason I'm saying this to you now is because you have to understand that love is the organizing principle by which Martin Luther King Jr. built all of his work. And so a lot of people know him with his call for nonviolent resistance, right? Nonviolence resistance. And so I'm going to talk about like how he came to those conclusions as well. But I did just want to recognize that love is the organizing principle, meaning that the animating force that's driving this person into the world is love. And I do believe that we should get to a place in our world where that is the organizing principle for all of the decisions that we make. I've said it before, but I think that love is something like the highest expression of our humanity, right? It's only inviting. That's the thing about love. If you start excluding people, you start saying, hey, this is my club and you're not in this unless you look like me, talk like me, believe like me, think like me, you're no longer talking about love, because love is always inviting. What we learn in love is that everything actually belongs. And if we use that as our basis for navigating the world, we find far less resistance, right? We find far less opposition. There's a line in the Tao Te Ching that says, you know, there's no greater tragedy than having an enemy in the world, right? And you could think about that. You could think about, well, what would it be like if you didn't have enemies? What if love was the animating force for your life? How would that change your business interactions, your family life, your social settings, the way that you looked at your enemy, right? The way that you looked at people. Because if you begin to exclude, again, you're not talking about love. Now, I want to talk about another reason why I find that, you know, what led me to understand that love is such an effective organizing principle. And it has to do with values. And this is what brought me back to starting to take another look at religion again in my life, and religion, but more all of the wisdom texts. Fun fact, religion actually, in the classical definition, I do believe it. In the new, what people project onto and think religion represents now, you know, I think you start to get into a little bit of dogmatic thinking that's probably not super conducive all of the time. Actually, Martin Luther King Jr. gets into that. But so we have to think about, first of all, we all have an internal value system, right? And now this isn't negotiable. So you could think about it this way. The reason that you know that you have values, even if you don't know what they are, is because you have to make decisions in the world. And so you think, okay, do I make this decision or that decision? Well, you can only make that decision based on your value set, right? This over here seems to be more important of that, more important than that, and so I have to go this way. Okay, so not only do you have values, but they're arranged hierarchically, and that's what allows you to navigate the world. Okay, now if you are to walk your value system all the way up to the top, you have to land somewhere. Okay, so this is why I say it. When I look at the human psyche, and this is something I found because I first dove into psychology not for religion, actually. I dove into psychology because I wanted to change my own life, because I had a whole bunch of hang-ups in life, and I had a whole bunch of sort of dis-ease in my mental state. And so I sort of dove into psychology in order to try to resolve some of that in my own life. It really had nothing to do with any altruistic sort of notions. And this is also why I think, just in general, if you're interested in something, you should pursue it, not because that's where you'll end up, but because that's your next step, right? Your interests are always guiding your way. Sort of your soul knows exactly where you should go. But just because you don't see the whole picture, right? I didn't realize I would maybe end up in this place where I'm talking about metaphysical principles when I dove into psychology, but here we are. Now, the reason that we're here is because I realized that, wow, every single person makes decisions by a value system. And if you walk that value system, there has to be a pinnacle. Now, what religion is saying is that the pinnacle of value systems is God, right? Now, understand that God, in the religious context, is a synonym for love. And so that's how we get to this place where love is an organizing principle, because everybody's got a value system. And so, as I was saying, what I found out when I looked into psychology is that we have the imprint of God in our psyche, right? We have the pattern for a God, for that way of thinking about the world. Now, you don't have to put the word God there, right? And most people don't. Most people put all kinds of other things at the very top of their value system. Drugs end up there a lot of times. Addictions end up there a lot of times. Sex ends up there a lot of times. Validation, material ends up there a lot of times. And so what happens is if you put the wrong thing in the very top of your value system, you start making decisions that lead to more, as I said, dis-ease in the world, right? Less integration. Your consciousness is diminished, not expanded, right? And so you want to put something there that as you climb, it invites you to be more. And if it's improperly inviting you to be more, it's actually expanding your consciousness. And so what I meant by the classical definition of religion is actually what it means is to, religioso from the Latin, religament is to reconnect. And so it is to look into the mystery of life and realize that the mystery, if you look at it long enough, will begin to reveal that it's all connected. And so in the classical definition of religious, I would say that I probably am. And so I wanted to tell you that because it's important that we understand that love is the organizing principle by which Martin Luther King makes all of his decisions and by which all of the words that I'm going to talk about today come through. For King, love was not weak. It forced you to rise above yourself. It was an invitation to be part of something bigger than who you are. Remember, love always includes. And so I think sometimes we get, certainly in maybe like the toxic shadows of our culture, we view love as this weak thing. I know that growing up, that's certainly how I viewed love, right? It was like if you admitted feelings, you had this sense of weakness to you. And what's interesting is if you ever try to walk back on that belief, you realize how wrong you are. How difficult it actually is to love people. Now, this isn't to like people. And so you can't lie to yourself about love. That's the interesting thing. And that's one thing I learned about reading this work of Martin Luther King is you cannot like somebody. In fact, it's probable that you will not like somebody, but you will love them, right? You'll understand that there's something below us all that connects all of us, that we're all sort of dependent upon each other in this life and that each other is sort of all that we have. But that doesn't mean that you like everything that people do, right? Now, in Martin Luther King's time, which we're gonna talk about because some of the quotes will relate to it, you have to understand that there was this, so African Americans were able to vote, right, in the country. And what Martin Luther King was trying to do with his work when he died is he was trying to get the U.S. government to protect people's right to vote. Because basically what happened is a law was passed that African Americans were able to vote. But then all of the southern states chose not to, or not all of them, but a bunch of the southern states chose not to allow it. And so basically, like people would not let them vote, so that they would go up. They have the right to vote, but the states were sort of just blocking people from their right to vote, and so there was all kinds of like hate crimes and all kinds of just brutal shit that was going on at this time. And so, actually, when Martin Luther King died, he had been petitioning Lyndon B. Johnson to pass this act, and actually, it was passed a couple of days after he died. So just understand that basically this is the struggle that he's in right now. Basically, he sees that we are all suffering because some of us are suffering. And that is the crux of his message. So we get into the foreword of this. I want to talk, you can hear a little bit of what he means by when he's talking about love not being weak, but actually being sort of the highest expression of who we could be. When he says, when I speak of love, I'm not speaking of some sentimental and weak response. I'm speaking of that force which all of the great religions have seen as the supreme unifying principle of life. Love is somehow the key that unlocks the door which leads to ultimate reality. The Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist belief about ultimate reality is beautifully summed up in the first epistle of St. John when he said, "Let us love one another, for love is God, and everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God." And then later he says, along the way of life, someone must have sense enough and morality enough to cut off the chain of hate. This can only be done by projecting the ethic of love to the center of our lives. And so what he's hinting at here is that love is sort of it's almost like our, Well, it's definitely our birthright, but it's almost like the greatest human gift as well, because what he's saying is that love is the thing that has the alchemical ability or properties to transform things that aren't working in this life so that they become things that are working in this life, right? But it's not easy to get there. And so as we get into what it means to have a tough mind and a tender heart, he talks about that division and how hard that, how you have to really dig into that. So one thing that I wanted to say though, before, I know this is 15 minutes before I even get into it, but he says, in this world, nonviolence is no longer an option for intellectual analysis. It's an imperative for action. So he's talking about nonviolence. So you think about it this way, right? So people are throwing rocks. Let's say you got two tribes and they're hucking rocks back and forth at each other and they're injuring each other. And you got to understand, when you have conflict, both sides think that they're correct, right? The problem isn't that you have opinions. I can't remember who said this. The problem is that you think that you're right, right? And so what happens is sometimes mystics or prophets or, you know, religious leaders, or we, you know, we've given them all kinds of names throughout time, but these people come along and they pull themselves out of the situation and they realize, listen, if you're throwing rocks at you and you think you're right, and you're throwing rocks at him and you think you're right, there's nothing that's ever going to change, right? So you have to understand, you're hurting each other for the belief that you're both right. Is there a belief that you could both have that would allow you to both exist in this place without the degradation of each other? Now, I read a book called Homo Deus, and in the author, Naval Harari, he talks about this idea that, listen, our systems, our weapons have been so developed that the human race, we will not be able to continue at the rate in which we have. Like, somebody has to come along and understand that there has to be something bigger than what divides us. And if there isn't, then we will destroy each other, right? And then nobody wins. And so, you know, it's hard to tell right now whether we're going to turn the ship around or whether, you know, people like us are just kind of applying hospice care for the mass extinction event. It's hard to know, right? Humans haven't really made up their minds. There's a lot of hate still out there. But understand that if we want this show to continue, kind of like I talked about, is there something above growth? Like, do we have to have some organizing principles that allow the whole game to keep going so that all the little games that we play in between, when we have all these little interests and all these things that kind of, you know, set our souls on fire, make us feel alive, is there something that we can do? Is there something we can believe so that everybody can do that and have an equal shot at that in this life? That's what I believe Martin Luther King Jr. is asking us. That's what he's telling us. So I want to get into this idea of a tough mind and a tender heart. So he says, the tough-minded individual is astute and discerning. He has a strong, austere quality that makes for firmness of purpose and solidness of commitment. Who doubts that this toughness of mind is one of man's greatest needs? Rarely do we find men who willingly engage in hard, solid thinking. There's an almost universal quest for easy answers and half-baked solution. Nothing pains some people more than having to think. So let's get into that. So what led me to this work was realizing that I needed to re-examine all of the beliefs that I had. I posted something on social media a little while ago that said basically, like, question the beliefs that you are almost certain of, right? So this is what happens, is we have these beliefs about ourselves and about the world, and they're formed as we are forming, as we're growing up. So we have all of these beliefs about how the world works, what causes, they're always based on causality. Like, if you act like this, it'll cause this. That's how our beliefs are formed, right? And then we have a picture of where we fit within all of this ongoing process of the world. Now what happens is, when that picture of how we fit in the world isn't perfect, if it doesn't align with reality, then we're told that by pain. We're told that by discomfort, because the way that we conceptualize the world isn't the way that the world actually is, right? And so this happened to me because I had conceptualized the world in a certain way, and as my business began to fail and as my relationships began to fail, the question was, do I double down on what I know, which led me to this point where I'm not extremely happy, or do I question the things that I'm absolutely sure of, right? Maybe the ego needs to be questioned. Maybe the things that I think are important need to be questioned. And so the thing that really stopped that like really stopped me in my tracks and made me at least start to question all of the things that I had believed is I was in the military and I was listening to this guy give a talk and he said, well, what if the person you kill turns out to be correct? And I thought, oh, shit, what? I don't know, what if? Because of course I think I'm correct. Of course the reason that I'm fighting for something is because I think correct, but they do too, obviously, enough to fight to the death for it. And so someone has to be wrong. And since we're both convinced we're correct, there's no real way of knowing who's what. And so perhaps the way that we figure it out is to realize that maybe there's a belief that would allow us both to coexist in this world in more of a harmonious manner. And so that was the thing. Now, I don't care if you can buy that or not, but it was that crack in my belief system that made me realize that, man, belief unquestioned, it's a bit of a pathology in this world. If you believe things and those things are above questioning, you're no longer able to find truth in your life. He goes on to say, the soft-minded man always fears change. He feels security in the status quo, and he has an almost morbid fear of the new. For him, the greatest pain is the pain of a new idea. You know, there's a test, there's a monkey test. So basically they put these monkeys in a room and they put a stepladder in the middle of the room and they put bananas at the top of the stepladder. Now, every time a monkey would climb to the top to get the banana, basically they would spray water from the ceiling and so all of the monkeys would get wet. And so it didn't take very long before the monkeys realized, okay, if anybody goes up that ladder, we all get wet. So we're gonna stop doing it. And so what happened is they slowly replaced the monkeys one at a time. And so they'd put a new monkey in, he'd see the banana and he'd be like, "Whoa, going for it." He'd start to climb up and then they'd get wet. So what happened is as they would put new monkeys in and as he would start to go for it, or she, I don't know the sex of the monkeys, but as they would start to climb this thing, what would happen is that all the other monkeys would beat that monkey before he even could go up at, right? Because they knew, hey, if you go up, we all get wet. So they would stop him from going up. Now here's what's interesting. Over the course of months, they replaced every single monkey. And so now that they were at a point where no monkey had ever gone up toward the bananas, right? And the researchers had decided that if the monkey climbed, they were gonna stop spraying them. And so now they had a point where they were all new monkeys, okay? And they continued this behavior, so if anybody tried to climb the ladder to get the bananas, the others would beat them, but they didn't know why. Do you understand this? Because they had all been replaced, so no monkey had never gone after the banana and gotten wet. Now you can think about in your life, in your job, in your existence, how many times we say, well, it's always been done that way, and we don't question it, right? And so we beat the monkey that goes after the banana, and we have no idea what happens if he actually gets it, right? Because maybe back in the day, things were different. Reality is always shifting, but we are slow to shift, right? So because reality is always shifting, we're always in an environment that's open to questioning, that's open to new approaches. But we, as the monkeys, tend to want to keep ourselves safe, and so we fear this change, and we would rather beat the monkey that goes after the banana, even though we don't really know why we're doing it or what happens if he does it. So I think that's a really just a great way to understand this. And then toward the bottom of this page, he also talks about it in religion, which is kind of why I talked about the classical definition of religion versus what we think of it now, because he said, soft-mindedness often invades religion. This is why religion has sometimes rejected new truth with a dogmatic passion. Right? So remember, if you are rejecting truth, or if you're rejecting anything just because it's new, then you're starting to get to the point where you're bifurcating from the path of truth, the path of wisdom, the path of love. All right, so we get into page 4. Now, I want to talk a little bit about religion and science. And so he says, this has also led to a widespread belief that there's a conflict between science and religion, but this is not true. There may be a conflict between soft-minded religionists and tough-minded scientists, but not between science and religion. Science keeps religion from sinking into the valley of crippling irrationalism and paralyzing obscurantism. Religion prevents science from falling into the marsh of obsolete materialism and moral nihilism. And so when love is your organizing principle. Remember, everything belongs. And so if you have this God, and this God is a synonym for love, that's maybe the best word we have for it in our lexicon. You have to understand that everything does belong. There's not a part of creation that would not support other parts of creation. Everything that grows together goes together. I've said that before. So we have to understand that we create these divisions because we're not tough-minded. We create these divisions because we want simplicity. We fear change. We want things to stay the same. We want things to stay so that we understand them, which often causes us not to do the really difficult work of grappling with our own beliefs and figuring out how it could possibly be that all of these deep human paradoxes could exist together in harmony. But everything does belong. This verse, that is too easy, right? We have to be more than that. And this is the eternal invitation of love. And when I talk about love, I'm talking about agape, okay? This is the word that the New Testament uses most times when he's talking about the love of God or Christ or something along those lines. And because what the Greeks understood, and I'm going into Greek 2 right now, and one of the reasons I'm taking it is because I really want to understand the minds and the language that all of the deepest wisdom that our culture has filtered through. And one of the first things, you hear this all the time, that they talk about is the Greeks had 7 different types of love. But in America, I wrote about this in my new book a little bit, we love our shoes and our job or our hobby and our partner and our family with all the same word. But that is insufficient, right? Words, they really are only secondary to their meaning, to the thing that they actually represent. And so there's a higher calling of love. There's an unconditional acceptance. And that's the love that we're talking about, where everything does belong. And if that's your guiding principle, what you realize is you can pull apart all of this confusion and all of this seeming adversity, and you still have a path forward. It is the alchemical response to human suffering. It is the thing that we can make our pain and turn it into beauty. That's just true, right? And there's not a lot of other ways that can happen. Okay, so then he says, now this is where I kind of wanted to talk context, where I said, like, it's important to understand that we are talking about, well, when Martin Luther King is talking about the gospel, he's talking about the first time that a morality structure was introduced to humanity, right? That's why I think this is important. So he says, too many politicians in the South recognize this disease of soft-mindedness that engulfs their constituency. With insidious zeal, they make inflammatory statements and disseminate distortions and half-truths that arouse abnormal fears and morbid antipathies within the mind of uneducated and underprivileged whites, leaving them so confused that they're led to acts of meanness and violence that no normal person commits. The shape of the world today does not permit us the luxury of soft-mindedness anymore. A nation or a civilization that continues to produce soft-minded men purchases its own spiritual death on an installment plan. So what he's talking about here is, as he's rallying America, he's saying, listen, if parts of us are suffering, we're all suffering, right? This is what compassion is. It's to suffer with, right? Remember, when I say passion, this is something you're willing to suffer for in life. Compassion is to suffer with, right? It's to see that this pain that you're feeling, it's our pain. We're all in this place together. That's a mode of being. We don't have to be in our silos. We don't have to be with our loneliness and our confusion and feel like this is something that we have to do on our own. We can do this together. But unfortunately, certain leaders feel as though they can use fear as a way to ignite their base and as a way to get people to support what they're doing in the world. And the problem is the ripple effect of fear. I've talked many times about fear on this show, right? What does fear want? What is the goal of fear? It's nothing, right? Think about all of the things that you're afraid of in life. What does that fear want of you? It wants nothingness. It's the antithesis of life. And so perhaps by rejecting that fear, we all come together and we live a better life. the reason I wanted to, I highlighted this part about politicians in the South sort of recognizing the disease of soft-minded people and then trying to amp it up, and they just spew fear and they spew hate and they use that as a way to amplify people, is because there are people in our world today that do that. But look, if you look back through history, those people are always on the wrong side of it. Right? Every single movement, no matter how, fear is so powerful. We all felt this, right? We felt this at the beginning of the pandemic. Fear can be used to rally people. It can be used to find belonging. It can be used to motivate people to do exactly what you want them to do. But it's limited in its utility to make real change in the world because it is self-defeating, right? And so you can look back through history and you can see all of these people, Hitler, all these people that use fear as the way because it's so powerful and it's so easy and it's such a good way to rally all of these soft-minded individuals. But what you see through history is that for some reason, love always wins. Not sometimes, always. And if it hasn't won, you just haven't waited long enough. Right? I've talked about this many times, that if you were born at all of these various times in history, you would think that you were really screwed, right? But you were like the world was going to hell in a handbasket. But then if you look back at history and you read it as one long drama of the human race, you see that the highest good always does win somehow. Somehow Gandhi defeats the entire British Empire and somehow liberates his nation with love only, though they had all of the fear in the world to keep people oppressed, to keep people enslaved. For some reason, this is the way that the world works. And I would say what Martin Luther King is doing here is he's inviting us to be part of the right side of history by having love as our organizing principle. At the bottom of it, he says, we must not stop with the cultivation of a tough mind. The gospel also demands a tender heart. Tough-mindedness without tender-heartedness, is cold and detached, leaving one's life in a perpetual winter, devoid of the warmth of spring and the gentle heat of summer. Your outer world, it's always a reflection of your inner world. And so the reason that I wanted to highlight this part is when he says the gospel also demands a tender heart, that's what I was talking about a couple weeks ago in that episode, right? It's the idea that there's a new moral structure that humans can use to navigate the world and build their systems off of. And if we can keep that at the center of it, it's gonna call us to be bigger than our divisions. It's gonna call us to be bigger than our simplifications. It's gonna invite us into this paradox, into the pain of other people. But in doing so, it gives us a better system by which we can navigate the world. And so this is the invitation that I want to leave you with. Moreover, we must learn that passively to accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system and thereby to become a participant in its evil. Oftentimes, you know, when bad things happen in the world, it's because somebody either condoned it or they simply allowed it. Talking about studies with that study that I was talking about earlier, I've got another one for you. I was getting ready to be an instructor at the Bud Schoolhouse. So for 3 years, 4 years, anybody that wanted to be a Navy SEAL or Navy SWIC had to come through my pipeline. And as I was I was the instructor for. And as I was getting ready to become an instructor for there, I had to watch all of these different studies on human behavior because, you know, you have a lot of autonomy as an instructor. And it's also a very brutal world, a world that's so brutal that if civilians were to actually see what goes down, it would be probably not condoned and taken down immediately. But I do believe that the difficulty of it, the harshness of it, is a necessity for the job that we're grooming people to do. But what that calls is that if you are a facilitator of a very harsh environment for a purpose, what it calls for you is to have an understanding of how that can go awry, right? You have to see your own shadows so that you don't pull all of these poor students who are trying to become somebody in the world into your shadows, because you can really, really do damage on people in this environment. And so this study was showing that these people would walk into a room, and so somebody with a lab coat would walk over, and there was supposedly somebody on the other side of the wall, and they had a shock button. And basically, this person in a lab coat had a clipboard, and he would tell them to shock people. He would say, like, you know, dial it up to whatever the voltage was. And at the very end of the dial, there was like a basically a lethal voltage, and it was shown on the dial to be lethal. And so the idea of this study is that these people would deliver the shock, and they'd hear someone on the other end be like, ah, and they would react to the shock. And so the idea was that these people in lab coats, who are very official, right? We tend to take orders from people that we think are official. That's the people we question the least. Basically, their job was to get them to shock these people to death, right? To see if they could do it. These normal people off of the streets. And what happened is so many people were able to be convinced to shock people to death for no reason that they actually had to go into therapy after. We had to be enrolled in therapy after to like pull this apart. How could they, because this is how PTSD happens, right? Most people think PTSD happens because you get exposed to something. That's part of it. But what happens most of the time is actually you see how terrible of a human being that you can be. And that's what leaves you stress the fuck out. It's because you see how awful of a human that you actually can be. And so we have to face these parts of ourselves so that we can ensure that we don't exist in them, right? So all these people who had not done this kind of work, that didn't know how to stand up to authority, that were just used to going with the flow, killed all of these people. Now, of course, they didn't really. It was all like smoke and mirrors. There was nobody on the other side actually dying. But you can see how easily we get pulled into cooperating with injustice, right? Into cooperating with a system that we don't agree with and that doesn't create a world that we want to be a part of. And that's the beauty of this invitation. That's the beauty of Martin Luther King Jr.'s work. He's inviting us to be part of a world that we actually want to be a part of. But what he's calling us to is a tough mind. He's saying we have to be better. We have to question the things that we're absolutely sure of. But we have to do it in a way that we recognize love as the organizing principle. It is the animating force by which we are making all of these decisions. Otherwise, yes, we will continue to participate in a world that people don't even want to be a part of. And that's the bigger problem. Our call is to be more human. You know, he ends saying, I am convinced that if we succumb to the temptation to use violence in our struggle for freedom, unborn generations will be the recipients of a long and desolate night of bitterness, and our chief legacy to them will be a never-ending reign of chaos. A voice echoing through the corridors of time says to every intemperate Peter, put up thy sword. History is cluttered with the wreckage of nations that failed to follow Christ's command, right? And so this is the invitation. This is what he's saying. Remember the tribes throwing rocks at each other that we talked about at the beginning. I understand that you think that you're right. I understand that you think that you're justified. But if everybody continues to operate based on that logic, we have created a self-defeating world, a world that does not work for everybody. And so, yes, our call is to be more human, whether in business, in politics. It is to reject the easy road of division, the easy road of fear. It is to reject all of these small parts of ourselves that we get so easily drawn into. We reject them for each other. And in doing so, we build a better world for ourselves because that's the world we get to be a part of. And so when I talk about like where's the rubber meet the road in this, in politics, you can see it right away, right? We have to be better. We have to resist in a way that says the animating force that's driving us has to be love, right? You can't talk me into not loving you. That's why I always say I love you at the end of the show. I might not like you, right? And in many cases, I might not like the behavior that you're exhibiting, but love is something deeper than that. It's something bigger than that because it's bigger than all of us. It asks us to come be a part of it. Now, if you can embrace that in every different component of your life, you get to live in a way that's a little bit different. You don't have to get caught into... Here's a good example in the entrepreneurial world. We're always getting pulled into like, here's how you make six figures. Here's how you hack your way to growth. Here's how you, whatever it is that I want you to pay for, right? The thing that's crazy is if you if you ascribe to this notion that love is the highest call of our humanity, and you treat people as if they're people, you treat them with love first, what you'll find is that you're able to build something. I'm doing it right now, so I am living proof that this works, that all of these hacks and all of these things, they're based on a world that lives off of division and lives off of smaller ways to be. We have an opportunity to embrace a bigger way of being, to be part of something bigger. And the way that we do that is we invite all of the other people in our lives, whether that's our customer base, whether that's our family that we disagree with that we see on Christmas time, whether those are the friends on Facebook that we disagree with, we invite them all into this place where there's something that exists bigger than the things that divide us. That is what I got from Martin Luther King Jr.'s sermon, A Tough Mind and a Tender Heart. I love you guys. Hope you have an amazing Monday. We'll talk later on Morning Coffee.